Lord, as we come to open up Job this evening, everything that we have prayed for this sister church, we want for us this evening. Father, so work that the power of your word and the breath of your spirit would come forth from your holy and inspired word and grow us and engage our hearts this evening. We love you, Father, for being able to end the day with you and your scripture. Speak to us in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, having now worked through the first entire cycle of speeches in Job, from Job chapter 4 to 14, when we come to chapter 15, we now move to the second cycle of speeches. It was the older and patient and friendly Eliphaz, is his name, who spoke first in chapter 4 and 5, who offered his counsel to Job, who began cycle 1. It is now the same, an eldest friend and comforter come to counsel Job, who begins cycle 2 in chapter 15. His response to Job comes to us in largely two sections in chapter 15. First, in chapter 15, verse 1 to 16, Eliphaz rebukes Job for the wickedness and folly of his words. And he calls him a man who drinks down injustice like water. Second, in verse 17 to 35, Eliphaz begins by saying that he will counsel Job. But he really just continues on doing the exact same thing he did in the first section and rebuking Job, saying that he will not only live with all the fears of the wicked, but his end will be comprised of the fate of the wicked as well. So we have an option before us when we get to chapter 15. We can either view it as one large rebuke from Eliphaz to Job, which is really what it is, or we can view it as one large rebuke that comes to us in two very similar sections from verse 1 to 16, then 17 to 35. Either way, the view of Eliphaz coming to Job in chapter 15 is that he is a wicked man full of wicked words that will meet a wicked end. This is the main point and the agenda of Eliphaz in chapter 15. So we'll work through it slowly. Verse 1 to 3. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "Should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he argue in unprofitable talk, or in words with which he can do no good?" With all this wind talk about Job's own words, Eliphaz's point here is that his words are empty. His words are empty. Job, in all of his knowledge, as we say today, is full of nothing but hot air. The east wind referred to in verse 2, for their context where they live in the east, would have been a wind coming out from the desert. And this wind coming out from the desert would have done nothing good for them. All it would have done is bring heat to them rather than blow in a storm that would bring rain and refresh and growth to all of their agricultural industries. Rather, this east wind, desert-like wind, would have been hot, unpleasant, and unfruitful. In the same way, Eliphaz says Job's words are like this east wind. They are hot, unpleasant, and unfruitful because really they don't do anybody any good. This is how he begins. Contrast that with how he began in chapter 4. Do you recall that? "Would you mind, Job, if I had a counsel for you? Would you take care to hear somebody trying to comfort you? He's done with comfort. All he's saying now is, you are a wicked man, full of wicked words. When they come out of you, I feel a blast of desert wind. It does no good for anyone who is hearing this. And we understand, perhaps from the context here, that more than just the friends are in this conversation. Because we learn in chapter 32, verse 1 to 5, that there's a younger man who's sitting on the outside of this conversation, Elihu, right there, who's in full nearness to everything being said. So it is probable that there are more people in view here who are hearing this that then makes their counselors more angry because all of the windy talk that's coming out of Job. This first section made me think of the usefulness of drinking salt water when one is thirsty. This is kind of what's in view here. It's almost cruel, right? You think of like the movie Castaway, and he's there talking to a volleyball and getting skinny and spearing fish. But in all of his thirst and hunger, even though he's surrounded by water, that salt water will do nothing but dry his innards out. I remember, isn't there a point where we all learn this as children? I remember being at the beach and being thirsty myself as a kid down in Sarasota at the Gulf and asking mom and dad, can I just drink this? And they're like, no, that's not good. I'm like, it's water. Why can't this go in me? Well, when this comes into view, I think Eliphaz is saying that Job may think his words are helpful and true, but the more he talks, the more damage he does. Just like the more you drink salt water, the thirstier you become. And so you want to drink more and more and more. It's a cruel cycle. This is what he's saying is flowing out of Job's mouth in verse 1 to 3. Let's go to verse 4 to 6. But you are doing away with the fear of God and hindering meditation before God, for your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you and not I. Your own lips testify against you. So Job is, according to Eliphaz, hindering and stopping and forsaking a true and pure religion. When he speaks of meditation before God, he's speaking of the way of life according to the holy ones. If you're holy, you live a certain way. Eliphaz says that by doing this and saying these things, Job has made it clear that he has departed from this way. And not only himself, but he is hindering by his words dangerously all those around him. So Job's words are not just empty and hot air. Now Job's words are dangerous. Job's words are dangerous. Perhaps verse 4 is the Old Testament equivalent to Jesus' own words in Luke 17, 1 to 2, when he says, temptations to sin are sure to come, but woe to the one through whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were cast into the sea, than that he should cause one of these little ones to sin. And so Eliphaz no doubt thinks that Job is guilty of this, because by his words he is not only leading himself astray, but it says his iniquity is teaching his mouth. The heart is only the vehicle to let out what's already on the inside. And by these words going out, he has departed from the way of truth. And all those who hear him are likewise going to be tempted to depart from the truth. So Job's words are dangerous. And his mouth is the very thing that condemns him, not Eliphaz. He said, it's you, not me. Your mouth is the one thing that puts you in condemnation. He expands on this in verse 7 to 13, saying that his words are haughty or arrogant. Are you the first man who was born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened in the counsel of God? And do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not clear to us? Both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. Are the comforts of God too small for you, or the word that deals gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away? And why do your eyes flash, that you turn your spirit against God and bring such words out of your mouth? Perhaps you have heard an older person say, referring to someone else who's old, they're as old as the hills. Have you heard this phrase? It's not much in our current generation. It's the older generations who say things like this. Perhaps it's generational degradation at play there with the use of language. But this is what's in view, I think, as Eliphaz talks. He said, "Were you the first man born? Are you older than the hills?" Implying that Job is arrogant and prideful, that he seems to portray himself as a kind of original creation of God before anything else was made. There was Job and God alone in their wisdom. Ironically, Eliphaz uses the same argument to shame Job in verse 8 to 10, saying he ought to remember that he's older than Job. And not to be surprised that they know these things as well. And so there's an age argument here. This is why he references his gray hair that perhaps, and is probably most likely, Job does not share with them yet. As he continues on in verse 11 to 13, Eliphaz asks Job more questions. If the counsel and truth of God, that he just so happens to be so wonderfully and so clearly presenting to Job at the moment, if that's good enough for everyone else and good enough for them in their old age, why is it not good enough for Job? It must be that Job's heart, I think we should read there, Job's sinful heart, has carried him off into folly, which has then caused his whole being to move off into wickedness. Now his eyes flash, his soul rebuts against God, and his mouth opens as a floodgate of sin rolls outward onto them and to everybody else in hearing distance. Then he says in verse 14 to 16 that Job's words are filthy. So Job's words, notice, are not only empty, dangerous, arrogant. Here he says they are filthy. As he finishes this first part of the rebuke, he says, "What is man that he can be pure? Or he who is born of woman that he can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water." In verse 14, Eliphaz is leveling the playing field, or he's attempting to here, saying that all men are born in this life of woman and are fallen and full of trouble, impure and unrighteous. And when you compare men to God, God is so holy and so pure that you can't compare man to God. So Job, who are you to say that you're pure? Do you not know that God is pure? God is so pure, in fact, that God doesn't even count the whole heavenly host around him to be as pure as he is. They all look wicked in comparison to him. Here, in what could be the final thought for Job in the first section of his rebuke, he makes something of a concluding statement that captures the essence of, I think, what Eliphaz is trying to say in this entire chapter. If all the rest of the entire creation isn't holy, Job, how can you be? You're not as blameless as you make yourself out to be. Logically, it can't be. But by claiming to be that, you show yourself to be abominable, corrupt, vile, filthy, and repulsive to God. You are so much these things. You don't just do evil temporarily or on occasion. You drink it down like water. It's a good friend, huh? Now we come to the shift in verse 17. And as we hit verse 17, we enter into the remainder of the chapter. But notice something here. In verse 17 and 19, there's a common refrain from what we've heard in other speeches before in these first 15 chapters of Job. After the initial outburst of rebuke, the pattern has been thus far with all these speeches, initial outburst of rebuke, then there comes a shift where the one doing the speech, the speaker, stops rebuking and starts instructing or giving counsel. This has been the pattern. Rebuke, it's a bit full of hyperbole and exaggerated and intense. Then there's a shift, but I know really what's going on, so just be quiet, sit back and listen as you hear the wisdom that you really claim you have. That's been the pattern so far. This is what Eliphaz says he will do in verse 17 to 19 when he says, I will show you, hear me, and what I have seen, I will declare. What wise men have told without hiding it from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no stranger passed among them. Before we get into this interesting parenthesis, at least it's in parentheses in an ESV. Do any of you not have a parenthesis here? Is it in that for every one of you? You don't have one? Not in the NAS? Not in the Holman? Interesting. Well, before we get to that confusing statement, which I do think is hard and confusing, remember, Eliphaz was the one who back in chapter 4 and 5, after initially rebuking Job gently, he began to unfold, remember, what he had seen in his spooky night vision. He said that it was a divine moment where something of heavenly origin came to him and taught him and told him that Job was wicked. Back then, after examining that, we came to the conclusion in chapter 4 and 5 that Eliphaz had not had a visitation with a heavenly being, but with one from below. And so, there's something similar about this statement in verse 17 to 19. I will show you, hear me, and what? What I have seen, I will declare. We've heard before what Eliphaz has seen, and it was nothing good. So this is more of the same. And this also is going to be not good. The same Eliphaz will once again declare what he has seen. And again, what he's about to say goes back just farther than him. It's the same thing again. I think this is what this parenthesis in the ESV means. It's not in the Holman or the NASB there. In verse 18 and 19, these strange couple of sentences can be taken, sure enough, in a few ways. It seems to be, this is the interpretation that I'll give you, and we can talk about this after if this is off. It may be But it seems to be that these wise men began life as these people knew it. And they did not hide their wisdom from the fathers, but then from the wise men to the fathers, it passed down to them, and they let no strange doctrine into their land or into their life that would then corrupt what was really going on. I think this is what's in view in verse 18 and 19. And so once again, it's the same old story that Eliphaz is saying, what I'm about to say, I not only have seen, but I've received from our traditions. Job, this is what we believe. So I think that's what's going on there. Let's move on to verse 20 to 35. We'll read this whole section in one, which is comprised with two things: the fears of the wicked in life and the fate of the wicked after life. This is what verse 20 to 35 say. We should read it as a whole because this is a large rebuke. He said he was going to instruct him. He's just picking up from verse 16 again. There's not much instruction here. It's all rebuke. Job, you're awful. Your words are wicked. Now here, you're wicked. Sorry, we'll read it. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days. Through all the years that are laid up for the ruthless, dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer will come upon him. He does not believe that he will return out of darkness, and he is marked for the sword. He wanders abroad for bread, saying, where is it? He knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand. Distress and anguish terrify him, and they prevail against him like a king ready for battle. Because he has stretched out his hand against God and defies the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with a thickly bossed shield, because he has covered up his face with his fat and gathered fat upon his waist and has lived in desolate cities, in houses that none should inhabit. Notice all the qualifying and conditional statements that are made onto this, which were ready to become heaps of ruins. Because of all this, he will not be rich, and his wealth will not endure, nor will his possession spread over the earth. He will not depart from darkness. The flame will dry up his shoots, and by the breath of his mouth he will depart. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself. Perhaps here's the one instruction in this section. Do not trust in emptiness and deceive yourself. For emptiness will be his payment, and it will be paid in full before his time, and his branch will not be green. He will shake off his unripe grape like the vine, and cast off his blossom like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren, and fire consumes the tents of bribery. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil, and their womb prepares deceit. There's not much counsel, is there? I think at this point we can be safe to say the friends are no longer giving counsel. All they're doing is condemning Job for what he has said. His words have been so polarizing, like Tim Tebow in the NFL. You either loved him or hate him, whatever he's doing now. Job's words are so polarizing that they immediately forsake counsel and give him nothing but rebuke. Nowhere, though, notice, in this final section, does Eliphaz say, Job, this is you that I'm talking about. He never assigns that this wickedness, that the wicked fear in life and that they will endure as their fate after life. Nowhere does it say, this is you, Job. But it's safe for us to say that by discussing both the fears and the fate of the wicked, after calling Job wicked in verse 1 to 16, that we can assume that Eliphaz means Job all throughout this passage and does not have another person in view. There are opinions that say other people are in view. I don't think those are legitimate opinions, or I mean, they're wrong opinions. That's what I think. Namely, this is what is before Job if he continues in his sin. This is the summarization of 20 to 35. Verse 20 to 24 focus on the anticipation of dire circumstances. The wicked man is forever plagued by an awareness of his doom, and he lives continually with the signs of death, and his attendant forces waiting to consume him. It's as if his sin will cause him to be a wanderer, where he goes around scavenging for food, unable to find food for him, which brings him endless anxiety and despair. Eliphaz has listened to Job speak well. If you linger in this section, you'll find that throughout the past responses that Job has given, and even in his own personal lament in chapter 3, the nouns and the verbs that Eliphaz uses in 20 to 35 are the exact nouns and verbs that Job has used to refer to himself in all of his speeches so far. And so it's as if Eliphaz is turning his own language against him and saying, all of this shows that you're not who you say you are. Clever of Eliphaz to do so, to use someone's own language against them. It's very difficult and very disarming strategy in debate. If you want to end a debate very quickly, do this. You will not be thought of as a kind individual, but you will win the debate and shame the other person, usually. This is what Eliphaz is trying to do here. And it seems to be that by stating it, he seems to be portraying that Job feels the way he does. Remember the agony of Job's speeches? It's agony after agony after agony that Job doesn't understand why he, a blameless man, is suffering as he is. It seems to be that Eliphaz is stating that the origin of all this agony is his own wickedness. And that's the reason why he's fearing the fears of the wicked right now. But continuing on in verse 25 to 27, Job may say that he is a warrior fighting against these things, but in reality, he's been fighting against God, who has gained in his fight against God ease and comfort. Did you see how he put the ease and comfort? He's gained a double chin and the leisure of a large belly. And so if you want to really attack somebody, don't just attack their character and what they do, attack what they look like. This is Eliphaz. Therefore, bankruptcy, darkness, emptiness, and fruitlessness are all before Job, because he not only has done wickedness himself, but he now, where does this come from, right? He keeps wicked company. And in that company, the only thing that can come out of that company, that's birthed by that company, is other deceivers like Job. Eliphaz is no longer gentle. Because of all his sin, Job's life, according to Eliphaz, will be full of subjective doom and will end in objective doom. These are Eliphaz's words. But as we end in Eliphaz here in chapter 15, we need to remember such a description of wickedness is not wrong. Everything that Eliphaz has stated so far about the wicked, about what the wicked fear in life, and how the wicked will end in life is true. The wrong part about it is that Eliphaz is applying it to Job, who is not wicked. We should understand this, though, I think. And this is where we meet the greater innocent sufferer that stands forth again and again and again in all of Job. The description of wickedness here and what the wicked will experience in life and in death is what Jesus experienced in his suffering and death for us. This is a description of the inner angst of the one who bore our sin for us, as well as a description of the sinner who dies in his sin. But we would not be doing this justice if we were just to end here with Job. We would only do justice if we brought this forward to its fulfillment in Jesus receiving all these covenant curses for us. So if we want to know what was it like for Jesus personally and objectively in his pain to do Galatians 3:13, to bear the curse that we deserved, for it is written, everyone who hangs on a tree is cursed. This is what it's like to have this type of angst and to feel forsaken by God. One of the seven statements that Jesus cried out. Remember, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is what he felt like. This is a preview of it, which then leads us to the same argument again and again. Jesus was not suffering for his own sin. He was suffering for the sin of the elect, of all who would one day believe in him all throughout history, covering all of their sin, past, present, and future. So I think that's a good place for us to end.